Welcome, everyone, to introduce the Ambassador Tampiro Mukanagi. Ambassador Mukanagi is the Ambassador and the Permanent Representative of Japan to the United Nations. He also holds the title of Ambassador at Large for Cooperation on International Law and was the Japanese Legal Advisor from 2022 to 2024. Ambassador Mukanagi was a visiting fellow at the Centre a few years ago and is currently a partner fellow. Many of you will be familiar with Ambassador Mukanagi's oral statement in the 2024 advisory opinion of the International Court of Justice, which focused on the prohibition on the acquisition of territory by force, as well as his book on the subject. And indeed, it's on this topic which he will speak today, but in his personal capacity. So, Ambassador, welcome back to the Centre. Or as you'd also.
Thank you, and Sandy, for a very kind introduction. It is a great pleasure for me to come back to Arata Park Center. I was a student, graduate student, about 30 years ago, and also visiting fellow at the center from 2017 to 2019. As Sandy told, today's talk is in my personal capacities. Sorry about this usual disclaimer. It is giving me some freedom to speak more freely in this talk. So before starting my talk, this is my personal background. I studied in Cambridge for diploma and LLM in international law. And I was visiting a fellow and then legal advisor in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs of Japan. In that period, I had opportunity to speak before ICJ on the advisory opinion on the OPT, Occupied Palestinian Territory. And that experience has let me think about this topic of acquisition territory by force. As Sandy kindly mentioned, Japan was very unique in that oral presentation. We focused solely on the issue of acquisition territory by force. Many other states talked about many different issues, but we devoted these 30 minutes per each member state to speak solely on this subject. Partly because I imagined that this would become the main issue of the advisory opinion, and which has been left over from the previous advisory opinion in 2004 on the oral advisory opinion. And I wrote this small book or kind of booklet after we finished our term in Security Council in 2024. Because I had more time and I wanted to do something interesting apart from the work in the New York. So I decided to write some paper and send to the publisher, and publisher agreed to publish this small book. I am still trying to get overview of today's talk. Main part of the my talk is the section 2 and 3. These are about the scope and the effect of the prohibition of acquisition of territory by force. But before getting into the main part, I'd like to put that discussion in the context, historic context. So I briefly review what we have done in the past 100 years in addressing this problem. I think I will basically focus on the prohibition of territory by force, which is abbreviated as PATF. Sorry about this abbreviation. It's not often seen in the academic literature, but to save the space in my book, I invented this abbreviation and it worked very well. So today, please bear with me about this strange abbreviation. And at the same time, I will also look at prohibition of use of force. It's also abbreviated as PUF. PUF and PATF appear many times in my presentation. Because the UN prohibition use of force can be an alternative rule of law against operation to do it by force when the third states find it difficult to apply punitive error. So these two rules will appear in my presentation many times. And the third part is about the effect of the prohibition of acquisition territory by force. Two questions. First is, does the right of self-defense justify acquisition territory by force? If state is using force in self-defense, can that state acquire territory in defense of its countries? That is the first question about the effect. And second question is the obligations for the third states. This is probably familiar topics for international law students, but we look at that question in the, at the second question section. And in conclusion part, I will briefly ask, have we made progress in the past 100 years? That is a very difficult question to answer. Now, production. This is about the history behind this question. In the interwar period, briefly speaking, you know, Germany was not happy about the new status quo in their territory after the World War I. And the League of Nations and Kelk-Briand Pact made effort, but couldn't stop World War II. Coming to Japan, my own country, Japan started to challenge the emerging legal regime outlawing vacation territory by and offer use of force. And Stimson Doctrine, as you all know, declared by US in 1932, was a landmark initiative to stop acquisition treaty by force. And it was the kind of beginning of the emergence of the CATBA in the history of international law. But I wanted to point out kind of a reality surrounding this rule. When states, especially powerful ones, are not satisfied with territorial status quo and also unwilling to give up their interests for the sake of international peace and security, there is always inherent difficulty in the world to stop attempts to acquire territory. This is a kind of sad reality, but I think it is important to know this out in mind. After the World War II, as you know, UN Charter prohibited use of force, but as you know, UN Charter does not explicitly refer to the prohibition of aggression military by force. And first of vision, this concept emerged was 1967, and when Security Council adopted Resolution 242 about Middle East, and it mentioned aggression territory by war. After that, 1970, the Friendly Relations Declaration adopted by the General Assembly clearly mentioned this prohibition. Maybe for the first time in the official document adopted by consensus in the UN. So I think it is very interesting. I mentioned that inherent difficulty in stopping aggression territory by force. First component, element, was dissatisfaction of the powerful state about territorial status quo. And why P5 countries agreed to this 1970 declaration? And it implicitly indicates that at that time, at least, P5 were happy about the territorial status quo in the world. That must be the reason why we could adopt this declaration. And question is, we adopt same resolution now? That is a kind of a difficult question to answer. But at least at that time, they agreed. And until 2014, when Russia attempted to annex Crimea. I think P5, a nuclear weapon state, did not attempt to acquire territory by force. There was 7 decades of success in stopping Russian territory by force by the powers. That itself is a remarkable achievement, I think, but it was kind of a temporary success, which does become a right time to review the current state of international law. And also, currently there is effort going on in stopping the acquisition territory by force. No, I think still majority or overwhelming majority of UN member states are, I think, holding the provision of acquisition territory by force. But Security Council doesn't work when P5 exercises veto. There are an alternative to TA resolutions and ICJ advisory opinions are often used. And what is the significance of GA resolutions? That is debatable, but when resolutions are adopted by overwhelming majority, I mean like 140 in favor and less than 10 against. That to me, or maybe many diplomats working in New York, really overwhelming majority in the General Assembly. That kind of situation, the GA resolutions have some weight as evidence of a member state's opinion. And for example, ILC quoted GA resolutions adopted in 2022 in the Juskogen's conclusions, was drafted by the Pradi, current ICJ judge, quite extensive. So some GA resolutions are referred to as an evidence of a state's opinion on the existence of rule of law or interpretation of rule of law. So also ICJ advisory opinion has a weight, especially when they are talking about the UN Charter, because ICJ is the principal judicial organ of the UN, even though advisory opinions are not binding in a technical sense, their opinion is respected. So these two parts have been utilized by the, for me, overwhelming majority of states in the General Assembly. And now there has been a criticism about the double standard after, especially after 2022, Russian invasion of Ukraine, but you can pursue single standard rather than double standard through these tools, GA resolutions and advisory opinion. So moving to the main part of my talk, which is about the current state of rule of law, and the scope is relevant prohibitions. I think to apply this ad verum is always a challenge. But in my view, this context and act are important. I think if you examine the acts which contribute to the attempt to acquisition territory by force and the context surrounding that act and analyze on the case-by-case basis, and you can find some conclusion on the application of use of the bill. In other words, it is difficult to say kind of automatic condition or application of elements constituting the violation of PUF and PATBF. And this approach is similar to the approach taken by Erin Popgier. I think she was here some years ago. I met her here. She wrote a book titled Prohibited Force. And she used this kind of approach, combining acts and the context together and examining if the combination exceeds the threshold of the violation. And this approach is, I think, also taken explicitly or implicitly by many governments. In answering the question to the parliament, our government always say the case-by-case analysis is important and the elements during acts and contexts and others will be taken into account. So this approach is nothing new to the government legal advisor like me, but I will look at the contextual issue and then look at acts and then combine them together and discuss what kind of conviction would violate these rules. Before looking at these elements, I would like to introduce another abbreviation. Sorry for that. But in comparing PUF, prohibition use of force, and PATBF, it is useful to note two different kinds of prohibition of use of force mentioned in the Declaration. First type of prohibition of use of force is the prohibition use of force to violate existing international boundaries of another state. And I call it type 1 PUF. I'm sorry about this as an abbreviation. This type of PUF applies to internationally recognized deployment of force to internationally recognized territory of another state. That's right. The second type of PUF is use of force as a means of settling international issues and use of force as a means of solving international disputes, including territorial disputes. And this is mentioned clearly in the Friendly Relations Declaration. I think it is interesting that Article 1 of Kellogg-Briand Pact actually refers to similar concepts. It prohibits recourse to war for the solution of international controversies. So that concept is still there in the Friendly Relations Declaration as a second category of prohibition of use of force. This may sound a bit familiar to you, but please forgive me for using this concept in the following, because it's useful for the comparison of the two prohibitions. And it's becoming a bit more complicated. But in the following, I will focus on this scenario as a potential attempt to acquire territory by force. And state deploys armed forces to an area of land which is not its internationally recognized territory and put it under its control and then take measures to annex. There might be other possible scenarios, but this basic concept captures almost all the existing examples of attempts to acquire territory by force. So in the following, I will use this model as a potential acquisition territory by force. And for this kind of situation, what is the important context to apply these prohibitions? That is the status of the area of land concerned. That is the most important context. As I mentioned, in the context of type 1 EUF, internationally recognized territory is a strong element, context, and contributing to the violation of PUF and PATBF. It's not automatic, but kind of nearly automatic application that if a state B deploys armed forces to state A's internationally recognized territory, it is very likely to violate type 1 PUF. And if state B declares its station, it is also likely to violate PATBF. And this likelihood, I think, is supported by its overwhelming support to the GA resolution ES11/4, adopted in October 2022, about Ukraine's, Russia's attempt to annex Ukraine's whole region. The vote was 143 support, 5 against, and 35 abstention. So for me, this was a sign of strong opinion among the members. Here, I would like to draw your attention to the advisory opinion of 2024. Was it about internationally recognized territory? Actually, no. It was not about a state internationally recognized territory. It was OPT. And OPT was not treated as a state territory in the ICJ's advisory opinion. This question is becoming a difficult question, but whether prohibition use of force applies to situation not between states have been very controversial, and many authors have written about it, and many of them are negative about application of prohibition use of force to non-state situation. But ICJ did that in this advisory opinion. They applied PATBA and PUF in one stroke in paragraph 179. It was very interesting, but ICJ didn't clarify any criteria or the application of PUF to the situation not between states. But again, this is difficult for issue for me to go any further from here because there's no indication of criteria. But also, this application of PAT, PF, and PUF was interesting. ICJ was looked like applying these prohibitions to an area of land, OPT, which has potential to become another state's territory in the future. And this potential for becoming another state's territory is an interesting possibility. And it leads to a question, does the PATBF apply to an area of land with a competing claims or disputed by two or more states? This is a kind of key question to understand the difference between the two prohibitions, PATBF and PUF, to me at least. This red box, where state A and state B have competing claims over an area of land, and B deploys armed force to the area. And this one would probably satisfy the violation of criteria for the violation of type 2 PUF, which is a use of force for solving international dispute. And this is exactly the international dispute happening on the area of land. So if B uses force to solve that issue, is PUF type 2 should apply. But if B declares an annexation, as also PATBF apply? That is a key question as today's talk. And is relating to the relationship between these two, PATBF and PUF. ICJ didn't talk a lot about this relationship. ICJ in the World Advisory Opinion and the 2024 Advisory Opinion simply said PATBF is corollary of PUF. That's all. What is corollary? That is a very ambiguous term, and no clarifications are available. And here in the blue rectangular box is my understanding of this difference. PATBF denies the acquisition of territorial title, not the control over the land. And if often state B has a stronger title, does not violate PATBF by sending armed force to the disputed land. In that sense, PATBF has a narrower scope of application than type 2 PUF. For example, as you might know, Eritrea Ethiopia Claims Commission found that Eritrea violated the PUF by sending armed forces to Badome, which was on the border between Eritrea and Ethiopia, but Ethiopia was administrating Badome before this incident happened. But the Eritrea-Ethiopia Boundary Commission, on the other hand, found Badome to be Eritrea state. In such a case, I think Eritrea would not violate PUF by deploying armed forces to its own territory. what is my understanding? And this understanding is correct. PADVL has a narrower scope of application than type 2 DUL. This is probably something new, and I'm not 100% sure about the correctness for this understanding. And this is partly why I'm here to talk to you and see if you also agree with this understanding. It's a very simple, I think, logical understanding of this difference of these two prohibitions. But it's a kind of starting point for thinking about the scope of the application. And if this understanding is correct, there is a consequence. For third states, in my view, it is difficult to know if one has stronger territorial title. So for third states, it is very difficult to apply PATPF. But type 2 PUF is probably easier to apply because it is probably clearer to acknowledge the existence of competing claims. And then one side deploys armed force, this prohibition might apply. But at the same time, does it always violate type 2 PUF is another question. No. So what is the next to think about the difference between these two? Is it even more complicated? I'm talking about that. But this complicated situation. So I think it is. I couldn't simplify this slide any further. But what I'm talking about it is application of type 2 PUF to the territory subject to competing claims. Again, as I mentioned, Territorial Claims Commission dealt with similar situation. And Territorial Claims Commission applied type 2 PUF and found Territorial violated this prohibition. And in that finding, they used the term peaceful administration existed in Badome by Ethiopia. But actually, this finding was criticized by some or many international lawyers, including maybe Christine Gray, I think. This criticism have some point, I think, because what does the commission mean by peaceful? Peaceful administration, in my understanding, just meant Ethiopia was administering Badome peacefully at the time of the invasion and probably since 1993 when Eritrea became independent. The incident happened in 1998, but only 5 years since independence. And that commission did not examine the roots of the conflict. The roots of the conflict was a mandate of the commission, but it didn't, like another commission, it did not actually materialize. So actually, the root of the conflict was not clear. That means, did this, was this administration established peacefully, or was it established through use of force? It was not examined by the committee. So I think this is a very important issue. No, another extreme example is Nagorno-Karabakh, maybe. No, Armenia's control over Nagorno-Karabakh since 1992-94 was established by use of force. In 2020, Azerbaijan took it back, and 2023 took it back by use of force. In this case, was the Armenian control over Nagorno-Karabakh peaceful? That is probably almost the same question I'm asking to the Badome situation. But the commission actually, I think, used peaceful administration almost as the same as de facto administration and applied this prohibition of use of force. So This is still, I think, controversial. I think it is better to have more peacefulness in the administration. I came up with the peaceful establishment of the administration here. This rectangular blue box number 2 is if A has not used force in establishing administration, say to B has not protested to it. This sounds familiar to you, I think. You know, Max Huber in the Island of Palmas case took similar concept as basis for entitlement to the territory. So didn't use force in establishing administration and not protested by other states. That is my definition of a peaceful establishment of administration. And this type 2 PUF, in my view, is related to the obligation to settle youth peacefully. It's under Article 2, Paragraph 3 or Article 33 of the UN Charter. And naturally, this application of this prohibition use of force have some linkage to the peacefulness of the establishment of the administration. That is the case. This peacefulness in established administration should have some more positive effect in applying the type 2 PUF. That is one possibility, but that is not enough. The square, the rectangular number 3, B became aware of the administration by state A, but did not protest. And also this administration and or this admission continued for a very long period without protest. This element should further contribute to type 2 PUF violation. They are, I think, stronger justification for the application of type 2 PUF than peaceful administration, in the sense Eritrea Ethiopia claims commission applied. So the last question here, if number 2 and number 3, these elements exist, does the PADBF also apply? Can third state decide to apply PADBF to this situation? And this is a very difficult question. But for me, I think there must be a case where even there are competing claims, the PADBF should apply, because in some cases state make claims even though they know they have very weak basis for the title. And if you say PADBF never applies to the area subject to competing claims, that to create a big loophole, kind of self-judging type of loophole. And that is not acceptable as a rule. So there must be a limit, but I don't know what is a limit. Now, about the context relating to application territory by force. And next, act, and the other elements of act. There are several acts contributing or constituting violation these two prohibitions. And the first one is an obvious one, use of armed force, is required for the violation of these two obligations, prohibitions. But by armed force, I mean not only regular armed force, but the security force, police force, irregular force also should be included in armed force. The second act or element of act is coercive intention. This is more controversial. And in 2002, Cameroon-Nigeria case, Nigeria argued that their action was based on the reasonable mistake or honest belief. And I think ICJ seemed to be accepting, at least partly, this plea. So several scholars have concluded that This would mean coercive intention is necessary for applying prohibition use of force, not PADV or PUF. But what is reasonable or honest depends on the situation and a little bit subjective concept. So it depends on the situation. For example, if state B deploys armed forces to an area where state A has peacefully established administration, like number three situation on the previous slide, and B has been aware of it, and B claim to be honest in sending, you know, armed forces to the area to take control. Probably not. And at least the burden of proof for state B to prove the lack of the, you know, coercive intention must be higher than other situations. So it depends on the situation, but coercive intention is probably necessary. Another non-violent use of force is a little bit different. In Costa Rica, Nicaragua case, in judgment in 2015, I think some of you know, but Judge Robinson and Judge Wada argued that Nicaragua's deployment of armed force to the territory, disputed territory, amounted to violation of prohibition use of force despite the absence of any damage or injury caused to the Costa Rican side. And the force was very small and carrying very weak weapons, and Costa Rica did not try to stop on the ground, so there was no exchange of fire took place, and there was no damage or injury. But Judge Robinson called it the non-violent use of force. And I think he is right when non-violent use of force has some gravity and create a fait accompli by actually being present in the disputed territory and here, the other side, compete with that force. That itself, depending on the situation, could be unlawful use of force. But in that sense, as Judge Robinson was correct, but it depends on circumstances. So non-violent use of force can be an act of duty. And in the case of, you know, competing Danes in the remote island, this kind of thing may happen because, you know, a remote island is not always controlled effectively by payment, so that could happen. And also gravity, this is another controversial issue in the applying the use of the venom. There's a disagreement on whether gravity set the minimum threshold for the application of Article 2, Paragraph 4. I avoid to make judgment on that long-standing discussion, but I think there's an agreement among most of the scholars that gravity continued to the violation of PUF, and probably PATBF. So the greater or graver the use of force is, the greater the possibility of violation. That kind of causal link, I think, exists. In that sense, gravity matters. In addition to that, to violate PATV, there are two additional elements of acts necessary: establishment of control through coercive measures, and acts displaying intent to exercise arm and control. This last one actually came from ICJ advisory opinion in 2024, because in that case, Israel did not expressly declare that they were annexed OPT. But ICJ found the violation of PATF because, you know, Israel's policy and practice amounted to acts displaying intent to exercise permanent control. Exercise permanent control was a term used by ICJ. So even if no explicit declaration of annexation exists, the de facto kind of occupation can be virus on peer DBF if it displays this kind of intent. So these are the contributing to the violation. The last one is the most complicated slide, but this is kind of a combination I mentioned earlier of the act and context. The left-hand side in the vertical, order, I put three contextual elements I mentioned earlier, square one to three, internationally recognized territory, peaceful administration. Here, I put 20 years for the number two and 50 years for number three. These 20 years and 50 years may sound the arbitrary choice, but yes, this is partly arbitrary choice. But I chose 20 years as a period. It is clearly, clearly much longer than 5 years in the case of Badome. Ethiopia controlled for 5 years over Badome, but 10 years is much longer. And 50 years is actually inspired by the Rictan-Spatan case in ICJ. It was a territorial dispute, but ICJ found Malaysia took administrative measures in Rictan and Spatan Islands for 50 years until the critical age. They didn't say 50 years, but you count that years. It's about 50 years. And ICJ called this 50-year period a considerable period of time and said that court cannot disregard the fact that at the time when these administrative activities were carried out, neither Indonesia nor its predecessor, the Netherlands, ever expressed its disagreement or protest. And it was the key, element in ICJ's determination of sovereignty. So, 20 years, 50 years, but these are kind of examples of the strict years. And two elements on relating to acts, violent and nonviolent use of force are put on the horizontal order. Then, red and blue boxes indicate the likelihood of a violation, in my views. So, in scenario one, directly organized territory, as I mentioned earlier, A to E, is very likely to violate both EUF. I put one PUF and PADP. In the latter cases, scenario two and scenario three, it becomes more difficult. Partly because for the third state, it is almost impossible to determine which one has stronger territorial title. But I also mentioned there must be a limit. And if you go from scenario two to scenario three, the likelihood of A to have territorial title increase, and I think naturally the likelihood of PADBX application will increase. That is my understanding. But as I said, it is probably in the real case difficult for South State to determine this kind of thing. But if the PADBX is difficult to apply, there's always a possibility of applying PUF, especially type 2 PUF. And that rule is actually very important in the public discussion among GA members. And there is a disagreement about the particular status of the place the armed forces deployed. I think alternatively, prohibition use of force should be looked at. So this, complicated matrix explains my basic understanding of the difference between PATBF and PPF and also the consequences arising from that understanding. So I'm not 100% sure, but it is intended to give you also. The effect of the PATBF. First, self-defense. Can self-defense justify acquisition territory by force? I think answer is no, but why no? 1970 Federation's declaration quoted here clearly denies any acquisition of territory by use of force without any condition. And actually, Japan, in the oral presentation, made this point and argued that it does not justify acquisition of territory by force. And ICJ said this on the right-hand side, paragraph 253 and paragraph 254 is quoted here. Occupation can, under no circumstances, serve as a source of title to territory to justify the acquisition by the occupying power. And it also mentioned that Israel's security concern cannot override PATBF. It's also mentioned in paragraph 254. And it, I think, at least strongly indicates that PATBF denies aggression territory by occupation involving use of force. I hope there is a consensus about this finding. And this finding itself is very important, in my view, right? And does not only apply to OPT, but also apply to Russia. As you know, Russia justifies its invasion by referring to collective right of self-defense. President Putin's letter, which was a statement and which was sent to Security Council as a letter attached to the President of the Security Council. And also they sent the same statement to ICJ in the Proceedings on Genocide Convention. They emphasized the collective self-defense. But when Russia attempted to annex all regions of Ukraine, they violated PATBF, whether or not they claim there was a right to self-defense. And this is probably useful single standard I mentioned, where there's no disagreement before to be applied in any place in the world, okay, regardless of the political context. So I think this is important. And next effect is obligation for third states. This is familiar subject to international law students. Maybe you know better than I do. As in, the Wilson Doctrine itself was about third states' obligation not to recognize. But paragraph 278 of Advisory Opinion of 2024 mentioned five obligations. And they are categorized in three obligations here. Number one is obligation not to recognize, the most obvious and famous one. And second one, obligation not to render aid or assistance. And third one was obligation to cooperate or ending violation. I read articles on state responsibility talks about these obligations in Article 41, paragraph 1 and 2. And paragraph 2 of Article 41 talks about first and second types of obligation. Now, Article 41, paragraph 1, refers to the third kind of obligation. But as you also know, ILC says this may reflect progressive development of international law as of 2001. But on the other hand, this might be also well known in 2022. On the draft conclusion on use cogens, drafted by Diotradi, conclusion 19 also refers to same obligation. This commentary explains that it is now recognized under international law. And I think it is significant that ICJ recognized this third category of obligation. One thing that is not very clear is that ICJ referred to not only the violation of PATBF, but also the violation of right to self-determination. In my reading, I think both contributed to the emergence of these obligations. So it does not at least die. These obligations also come from PADBF, not just from the right of self-determination. So in the case of Russian invasion of Ukraine, many states took measures against Russia. And there are many discussions about the third party countermeasures and so on. But in my view, I think the third category of obligations is important. And this should be taken into account in interpreting or applying the relevant rules of international law to these measures taken against Russia. The result of this taking into account is not clear, but still this obligation exists and states are taking measures, partly to stop Russian aggression or Russian attempt to acquire territory by force. So if you are applying the trade rules, investment rules, this obligation should be taken into account. But this obligation, I must admit, is not so strong obligation. I mentioned in my book, is that similar to due diligence obligation. So states implement this obligation in their capacity and commensurate with the seriousness of violation. There is a limit, and I think it's not very strong obligation, but it's important to take into account. Last week, and as a conclusion, people do it from a pessimistic point of view. Unfortunately, still, that inherent difficulty is there, or maybe it emerged. As I said, 1970 was probably the high time, and now that high time is gone. So, they consider themselves as powerful enough to deter other states from voting right to political self-defense and intervene in the situation, and also consider themselves as resilient enough to survive measures taken against it. Unfortunately, international law cannot effectively prevent it from attempting to acquire territory by force. So what can we do now? This is another weak conclusion, but I think use of international law is useful. I quoted Kennan and Breyer. As you may know, Kennan called international law a gentle civilizer of states' behavior, and Breyer called the constitution for saner international order. There are still inspirational description of international law. It's not panacea, also Breyer said, but it works if wisely used. But how wisely it should be used? As I mentioned, development of a single standard through advisory opinion or General Assembly resolutions, I think useful. And also, what has become clear should be utilized as a path defense for PADBF. Denial of acquisition to self-defense is very useful, and universal single standard. And also the use of a type 2 PUF should be considered as an alternative rule. So these are conclusions. Also obligation, especially number 5, obligation is useful. And if states do not want to violate the obligation of observed, it should take a proportional approach. And that would have some impact on these violators of international law. And lastly, I believe legal advisors. By legal advisors, I don't only mean the government legal advisors, but people directly or indirectly advising governments have responsibility as the stabilizer of international relations. Difficult at this time But we should make efforts to advise policymakers to make legally sound position easier, said Taka. And we are struggling every day with this responsibility, but this is also the way we can contribute to the safer international world. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for taking us through some very, very complicated issues if it's not just structured in a way. We have time for probably one round of questions. So, let's start at the front. Johannes, something.
So, thank you for your wonderful presentation today. I would like to ask you three quick questions. The one is regarding to the relationship of the right of self-determination.
Maybe you could just choose one because we don't have any questions.
All right, then I'll focus to this one. One is the relation with the right of self-determination and the two prohibitions, and whether it is possible for an unlawful acquisition of territory to become lawful through self-determination.
Should we take a few, or do you want to
answer? That one is very good question. And I have been thinking about that question after I have finished it. And to be honest, I don't have answer. It's so, right to self-determination is even more complicated subject matter. The ICJ did not clarify the relationship between these two, because in that case, violated both right to self-determination and the previous right to self-determination. There's no contradiction. So where there is contradiction between these two variations, which one is stronger? That's, I'm sorry, I cannot answer, but this very important point depends on the situation, and that could happen in some situation. But I think from the context, OPD, example, but some states, some people have a right to self-determination and exercising that right, and was taken back by another country by force, then which prohibition applies? Maybe both applies. So we have to decide which one prevails, and that I'm sorry I cannot answer without a specific context, but I think that's very important.
Thank you, Ambassador, for your speech. I have a question on slide 8. I'm just wondering if you could elaborate more on how do we draw the line between type 1 PUF and type 2 PUF? Just because a lot of the times a state might use this area if there's a competing claim to it to justify what is considered type
1. Thank you. That's a good question. That question is about what is internationally recognized territory. That question actually was addressed by the Office of Legal Advisors of the UN before. And in practice, it is probably easy to agree, Crimea. Plus, I believe Crimea was internationally recognized territory of Ukraine before 2014. And I'm now writing a piece on Nagorno-Karabakh. And Nagorno-Karabakh was internationally recognized territory of Azerbaijan before 1992. So I think there are evidence. The most powerful evidence is the state claimed on some right to that area. It still has recognized that area as another state's territory. Russia's case was very clear. And Armenia also recognized Nagorno-Karabakh as Azerbaijan's territory before that incident, that case in 1992. So these are the evidence. But in other practitioner, in many cases, it's not so difficult to determine which one the international recognized and which one are not. States actually use some preliminary measures or tax measures imported from that country, treating that that area as a part of the state A or part of state B. That kind of evidence exists. So in practice, it is not difficult. So differently, type 1 and type 2 depends on what is internationally recognized territory, and that will depend on the evidence. And I think that is not difficult, impossible to get.
You have time maybe one more question.
Thank you. There was a comment. I wanted to say that I think your point on slide 13 about nonviolent use of force is a really important one. And you gave us an example, the case of Costa Rica and Nicaragua. And actually, I was involved in this case at the time. And the reason Costa Rica didn't send didn't oppose Nicaragua's actions was twofold. One was Costa Rica doesn't have a standing army, so they would have had to deploy the police. And two is that they actually saw it as a binary choice at the time. And they decided that the better course of action was to bring the case before the ICJ. So, you know, if we were to hold that sort of motivation against the state and say, oh, you can defend yourself, therefore, it wasn't the use of force, I think that would be arbitrary from a normative perspective.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you. I think your comment is very valuable. I think it was kind of pity ICJ did not dig into this question, but it is simply because the dispute itself was solved through the ICJ proceedings. So that is that kind of situation doesn't exist between Russia and Ukraine. Russia and Ukraine do not go to ICJ settling dispute, but Costa Rica, Nicaragua did. So from the court perspective, there's no need to go in further than that. But the fact remains, this violation was not determined by ICJ in that case. And why was that? And that is a question I have been asking myself. And your explanation explains to some extent, but maybe the Nicaragua's use of armed forces is quite limited in that case. Small number of personnel sent, and they only had small weapons. In usual situation, they could have overwhelmed. But Costa Rica is a very peaceful country without armed forces. So it was kind of unique situation. So this case still lingers in my personal thought. But I think the fact that they agreed to go to ICJ is a very important factor for ICJ to avoid this finding in this case.
Do you join me in thanking Kennedy for trust?